So I'm Rick Hansen. This is November 15th, I've just been reassured, 2017. And I wanted to pick up on what I was saying during the meditation and then lay a foundation for it. So if you were in the room and listening when I was talking during the meditation at all, I was drawing your attention to the very repeated and emphasized recognition, sometimes called insight, or in Pali, the language of early Buddhism, vipassana. The experiential insight into the nature of experience, of all experience, independent of content, the nature of the sounds, the nature of memory, the nature of wanting, the nature of the sense of self, all experience, as having certain fundamental characteristics, four in particular. One, impermanence, transience, kind of it's continually shifting and altering. Soon as it appears under our noses, it changes into something else. Second fundamental characteristic, compoundedness. So many pixels, when your eyes are closed, there's so many pixels there. So many aspects of sound, so many sensations happening, so many thoughts, so many reactions, so many mental processes, so many threads in the tapestry of experience, compoundedness. And then the third attribute, what's called interdependent arising, the notion that whatever's happening in experience in this moment depends upon causes. And those causes extend out and down into whatever was happening the previous moment, as well as into the whole body and how the body is constructing and constraining and conditioning this moment of experience, primarily through processes that pass through the nervous system and especially the brain. And the causes extend, though, clearly, of this moment of experience beyond this body, out into nature and oxygen and plants that produce oxygen and a star 93 million miles away that sends photons here that take 8 minutes or so to arrive, which fuel processes inside plants that, you know, express oxygen that we inhale, their exhalations and all the rest of that, other people, language, friends, family. This sort of keeps going and going and going and going. And you might have a sense as well of the ways in which the causes, the fabric of causes, the tapestry of causes that in which this moment of experience is a kind of a local ripple. That fabric of causes extends out into material reality as well. And there are various very trippy ways to recognize that, including this recent finding that occurred locally August 17th, in which scientists were able to measure subtle ripples due to gravitational waves in the fabric of space-time, due to the fact that a couple of neutron stars, 100 plus million light years away from here, which is to say 100 plus million years ago, collided into each other. And their explosion was so titanic when they did that, that it literally shook the fabric of space-time. We all, in ways we didn't notice at the time, momentarily stretched slightly as these gravitational waves rippled through us and stretched the continuum of space-time slightly due to this event. Whoa, talk about dependent origination, right? So we have these three attributes, fairly straightforward: impermanence, compoundedness, and interdependence. So no moment of mind, no moment of experience has absolute self-existence. It doesn't exist on its own. To paraphrase John Muir, when he says, when I look out there, I see that everything in the universe is hitched to everything else. Given that my father was born on a ranch in North Dakota, late November 1918, I'm very fond of that word, hitched. So we realize that we're hitched to everything else, interdependent arising. And then following on that, there's a very important kind of follow-on insight that the ordinary presumption of self as some entity inside that is the sort of screenwriter and director and composer of the unfolding stream of consciousness is somehow in charge. You start to realize, wow, there's nobody constructing any single moment of experience. And in some sense, there's no entity that's owning the experience that's just simply occurring locally, which goes to a release of the ordinary sense of ego I. Okay. So those are four fundamental attributes of experience that are discernible directly. It helps to have a relatively quiet mind and be at peace and relax and somewhat at ease. That supports that kind of vipassana or insight. And on the basis of which, so the question is, why would the Buddha recommend that? And what happens for people as that insight ripens and deepens and becomes more embodied in real time and more accessible, it starts coloring your consciousness increasingly. As that happens, we tend to lighten up. We don't take our thoughts and feelings and sensations and desires so seriously. We don't feel so implicated in them. So we don't feel so identified with them or possessive of them. And we're able to hold them much more lightly, which also enables us to hold the experience of others much more lightly. And there comes with that a growing clarity. It's often quite poignant that the conventional and frankly biologically driven strategy to somehow hold on to and thingify transient, insubstantial experience is doomed. It's impossible to do. You can't hold on to the waterfall at the edge of now as it streams right by you. It's futile. And it's also saturated with frustration and tension and contraction and suffering to attempt to do it, even though, of course, the ordinary mind attempts to do that all day long, even in dreams. And so that's kind of a foundational description of a very profound, essential teaching. There is a sutta I'm trying to remember that goes through a series of steps in which the teaching essentially says, you know, this is good, and then the next thing is even better, and then the next thing is even better than that. So it's sort of like sharing food with a stranger is good, sharing food with a relative in need is better, sharing food with a monastic, a monk or a nun is better than that, you know, and then it just keeps going. Ignore the hierarchy, but the point is it goes and goes and goes, and it just gets really amazing, and then it culminates in this sutta, this teaching. A single moment of recognition of impermanence is better than all the rest. So that's really valued. It's really valued. So that's very fundamental Buddhist teaching. Worth, I think, encountering and practicing with in its own right. Meditation supports that felt recognition, that liberating insight. Sometimes there are moments of almost revelation that are shocking and transformative, and after a while we kind of settle down into a more ordinary kind of consciousness, but there's still something that's changed inside us. It's a really important and highly recommended in the Buddhist tradition insight into and felt recognition of our own experience. And it can become theoretical, theological, abstract, and kind of lifted off from ordinary life. So I wanted to ground this fundamental teaching about insight into experience in one in particular very well known, commented upon suttas about how do we, what do we count on? And the Buddha emphasizes in that first sutta I'll read to you, we count on our own observation of what works, of what's useful, of what seems true again and again, not some kind of doctrine that's handed to us and not some sort of claim of authority. Don't want to read that first. And then the second one I want to read is a description of four of the five primary moral precepts in Buddhist practice that are really foundational for insight and also foundational for living in peace with others. This year, we've had a lot of focus on relationship and mindfulness of relationship, And these moral precepts are very foundational for living in harmony with others. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to read these suttas. I might sort of explicate or comment on a word or code word or phrase from time to time. Mostly I'll just read it to you, and then we can talk about it. And often what I do when I read this sort of traditional material that's been handed down to us from 2,500 years ago, this is a collection of teachings that relate to especially living in harmony with others. I'm holding up the book here. But the suttas themselves were handed down orally for centuries. I'm sure a certain amount of noise drifted into the signal there. A certain amount of editorializing. You can, from time to time, hear the moralistic finger-waving of some abbot, you know, lecturing typically young male monastics to get a grip, you know, or not get a grip, if you know what I mean. So some of that comes through, but still there's something else coming through there. So I'm just going to read it to you straight. Imagine a primarily rural, agrarian, patriarchal, medieval, pre-literate culture, and I'll just kind of take it from there. Okay? So the first is the so-called suttas for the Kalamas. So just to place it, talking 2,500 years ago, northern India, after his awakening for 40 years or so, the Buddha would just basically wander around, just eating whatever was placed in his bowl. People would gather. They would stay with him, so a kind of wandering troop, the Buddha, and initially the male monks, and then over time, female monastics would travel with him. And he'd go from village to village, and people sometimes also would dispute with him. They would disagree, or they'd say, "Who are you? What's up?" And okay. So it's in that context now that he came to apparently a village of where the people were known as the Kalamas. So here we go. The Kalamas of Kesaputta approached the Blessed One. So I'm not going to edit any of the devotional language. This is just going to be straight up. The Kalamas of Kesaputta approached the Blessed One and said to him, "Bhante," an honorific, "there are some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta. They explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, denigrate, deride, and denounce the doctrines of others. But then some other ascetics and Brahmins," you know, high status people, "come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, denigrate, deride, and denounce the doctrines of others. We are perplexed and in doubt, Bhante, as to which of these good ascetics speak truth and which speak falsehood." Buddha replies, "It is fitting for you to be perplexed, Kalamas. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. Come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our guru. But when, Kalamas, you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. When you know for yourselves. What do you think, Kalamas? When greed, hatred, and delusion arise in a person, is it for his welfare or his harm?" And I'll leave the gendered pronouns alone. "For his harm, Bhante. Kalamas, when overcome by greed, hatred, and delusion, with mind obsessed by them, destroys life, takes what is not given, transgresses with another's wife, and speaks falsehood, and he encourages others to do likewise. Will that lead to his harm and suffering for a long time?" "Yes, Bhante." By the way, right there we have the first four of the five precepts. Do not kill, do not steal, do not engage in sexual misconduct, do not speak falsely. We'll come back to those. What do you think? Buddha asks, are these things wholesome or unwholesome? Unwholesome, Bhante. Blameworthy or blameless? Blameworthy, Bhante. Censured or praised by the wise? Censured and by the wise, Bhante. Accepted and undertaken, do they lead to harm and suffering or not? Or how do you take it? Accepted and undertaken, these things, the Kalamas replied, lead to harm and suffering. So we take it. Thus, Kalamas, when we said, come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, but when you know for yourselves these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censured by the wise, these things if undertaken and practiced lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. It is because of this that this was said. Come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition or because you think the ascetic is our guru. But when you know for yourselves, these things are wholesome. These things are blameless. These things are praised by the wise. These things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should live in accordance with them. What do you think, Kalamas? When a person is without greed, hatred, and delusion, is it for his welfare or for his harm? For his welfare, Bhante. Kalamas, a person not overcome by greed, hatred, and delusion, whose mind is not obsessed by them, does not destroy life, take what is not given, transgress with another's wife, or speak falsehood, nor does he encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to his welfare and happiness for a long time? Yes, Bhante. What do you think, Kalamas? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome? Wholesome, Bhante. Blameworthy or blameless? Blameless, Bhante. Censured or praised by the wise? Praised by the wise, Bhante. Accepted and undertaken, do they lead to welfare and happiness or not? Or how do you take it? Accepted and undertaken, the Kalamas replied, these things lead to welfare and happiness, so we take it. In other words, having a mind without greed, hatred, or delusion, and not killing, not stealing, not speaking falsely, not engaging in sexual misconduct. Thus, Kalamas, the Buddha continues, when we said, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, but when you know for yourselves, these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should live in accordance with them. All right. So, in a moment, hearing what you think of all this, underlining a couple of points. One is, it's about direct recognition for oneself, basically, of what could be summarized in the Dr. Phil question. So, how's that working for you? For better or worse, seeing for yourself. And then the second main underline here is the what, working for you or not, a mind engaged with greed, hatred, and delusion or not, and also conduct that kills, steals, lies, or harasses, or cheats, or transgresses, or not. And I find it's really interesting that what the Buddha was teaching here in terms of what he was urging the Kalamas to judge for themselves was not some kind of esoteric bit of theology, some kind of cosmic metaphysical statement, but rather what's happening inside your own mind, greed or not, hatred or not, delusion or not, moral conduct or not. That's what he was really encouraging them to pay attention to. Okay. What do you make of all that? Including what is it like to just listen to a voice coming down to us from a couple thousand years ago?
So I gather he's saying, you can do it inside of there, know for yourself through meditation. No?
I think that's a who knows, but I think he would broaden it from that. In direct life. What happens in your relationship when you lie to somebody? Yeah. So what do you think about that? In other words, knowing it through meditation, certainly, but also knowing it in everyday life, doing business, right livelihood, relationships, reflecting on your history.
But when the Pali sayings go on like that, I get a little confused.
Oh, and plus you're listening to it. It's a lot easier to read it. And I find that for myself, there's a transmission coming through the words, you know, including some of the weird traditional aspects and the gendered quality of it and some of the references. And also, I take this a lot as essentially Dr. Buddha or Coach Buddha giving us a diagnosis and a plan and then judge it on its merits very immediately and concretely. So I really encourage people to study. To study the Dharma.
But to me, the most powerful thing is know for yourself.
Yeah, exactly right. And yeah, that's right. Okay, other people, including the moral parts? What do you make of it? Yeah.
It just seems like they're teaching the monastic, you know, to the lay people about the precepts and living your life would cause you to, you know, abandon the three poisons if you were to live your life that way. But to be able to understand it and pick up on it, you know, and understand it, well wait a minute, that me looking at that other guy's wife, maybe that's not right. You know, where does that fall in these three poisons that is going to corrupt my mind to where if I continue with it, it'll just get me craving it more and more. And then the suffering just tumbles after that.
Thank you very much for that. And I'd like to restate what you said, just for people in general. Correct me if I'm misrepresenting it. Really profound and powerful point, I think completely true in my view and experience, that you're pointing out it's on this moral foundation, not killing, not stealing, not lying, not cheating, or flip it around the other way, supporting life, supporting generosity and flourishing, seeking the truth in speech, honoring wholesomeness in relationships, that seemingly quite mundane moral practice, virtue, gives rise to increasingly elevated states of consciousness that have less and less greed in them, less and less hatred in them, and less delusion. Right? So that's very far out, what you're emphasizing there.
You also have a fifth, which is, you know,
not intoxicating yourself.
The intoxication, but you know, Jack Kornfield will still say, you know, alcohol in moderation is.
There are debates about the literal meaning, but yeah. But sure, okay. And there are many kinds of intoxication. The Buddha primarily talked about liquor, the words coming down to us are liquor, wine, and drink. But there are other forms of intoxication beyond substances, too. Okay, great. Other comments or takes on this? What do you make of it for yourself? You know, seeing for yourself. How much do you actually see for yourself? And what's it take to keep pushing through to knowing for yourself what's true? Wow. I find this, obviously you could go political with it, you know, piercing the veil of fake news and all the rest of that, and disinformation. But even just immediately in our own experience, like I had a little weird tiff with my wife. Some of my major Dharma stories relate to my tiffs with my wife. And it happened earlier today. And one of the things that I've been reflecting on, I'm going to talk about this a little bit in terms of seeing what's true, knowing for yourself what's true, is how so much suffering, the nature of suffering, at bottom is due to the fact that we got sucked into one tile in the mosaic of reality, of what was really happening. We got sucked into one characteristic of the other person, or we got sucked into one moment in the larger history of our relationship. We got sucked into one part of the larger whole. I'll spare you the gory details of what I got sucked into. She used a word, has a certain charged meaning to me and in our relationship. Harama, harama. Okay. And I got sucked into the tendency as to use, to do certain things, so fine. But what about bouncing out wider to see the whole person you're in a relationship with? You know? Everything about them. And the pressures on them, and your part, ruh-roh, my part, in the pressures on them. What's that like? So it's not a small thing to keep trying to really know for yourself what's actually really, really true in the full picture, including knowing for yourself what's true about yourself, including many, many wonderful, wholesome, beautiful qualities. This effort to keep knowing for yourself what's true is so fundamental, and it's easy to just bat it away as like some sort of saying on a needlepoint sampler on the wall. What do you think about that? Yeah, right there. First you, then you. Yeah, you.
I think that the challenge is oftentimes trying to see what is true.
Yeah.
Because we tend to get, as you said, sucked into the one tile.
Yeah.
And so the truth as we define it at that moment is not necessarily the truth as we define it when we look from the outside. And that, and being able to kind of zoom back out and see what that is, that's the thing that is, that's the learned skill, right?
Yeah.
You actually get meditation as well.
It does help, doesn't it? Yeah, to, just to restate it slightly, to, it's not so easy to do, but we train to be able increasingly to do it in real time. Like there you are and you're aware, whoa, this irritation is arising. But there's a sense that that irritation is like this big smelly bubble of swamp gas coming up, but it's inside the whole Everglades or something like that, you know, of your own mind. Yeah. Or even if you're caught by it, then you come back to your senses relatively quickly. For me, it was a few hours. Wish it was sooner, but oh well. Moments of awakening many times a day, right? Gradual cultivation. So, yeah, exactly right. And there are things you can do as well, but I think part of it is to set the intention to know for yourself what's true. And to ask yourself right now, for example, do you feel like your trust in what you know is true has been undermined, was undermined in your childhood? Many childhoods, that trust in our capacity to really know what's true gets undermined. Or has it been undermined maybe in a key relationship or relationships with some people who keep telling you, oh no, you don't really feel that way. Or no, no, you shouldn't really feel that way. Or, oh no, I'm not really doing that thing. Mm-hmm. Who are you gonna trust, me or your lying eyes? Right? The old line. So I want to underline that. Really, okay, yeah.
I was raised Catholic, and my mother was from El Salvador, and so it was a very conservative form. Mm-hmm. And going through grammar school, I remember in high school and even college, the desire for you to be non-thinking, that they knew the answer is not.
Ah, thank you.
And it's taken me years to now say, no one's telling me what to do. I make that decision.
Yeah.
I decide for myself what my truth is.
Yeah.
And some people are very stuck there, still. And it's not just Catholic churches, other churches.
Yeah.
Where the pastor or the minister or whatever is everything.
Yeah.
And I much prefer this.
Do you mind if I ask you,
yeah,
how did you help yourself along the way claim your own seeing of the truth?
It took years. I got angry when I went to UCLA. I'd go to church and they would pass the basket and make demands and anger would come up. Like, this isn't right, is it? And they also sent me, I went to the, I can't think of the name of the center, but it was for college students who were Catholic to go out on the campus and interview other kids to stimulate conversation or whatever. Well, I wasn't a personable person. My father was an abusive alcoholic, so I was a deep bowl of silence. And
you were a deep bowl of silence? Well, of silence. Yeah.
That's how I was described in high school. And so when I went out to campus, I wasn't comfortable doing that, let alone experienced or anything. So that increased my anger. And I hadn't gotten to the place where I could stop going to church, but I ended up being a teacher, teaching in Napa. And I remember one day sitting and watching the clock go from 12, which was the last mass that day before you had a mortal sin, and watching it go all the way down to 12:25 when the gospel was. And it freed me.
I don't quite follow.
Well, you'd have a mortal sin if you didn't go to church and hear the gospel and stay for Mass.
Okay.
Okay. There were lots of rules.
Uh-huh.
And I decided I didn't believe in mortal sin anymore. I was going to exercise my freedom. That's what was the first step for me.
Yeah.
And then I had other steps. You know, like my first husband was not a Catholic. And I went to the Monsignor of my hometown, Burlingame, which I didn't know was very conservative. And I asked if we should get married. His first question is, was he a Catholic? I said, no. Oh, well then you can't have a, you can only have one announcement in the newspaper, no. One bridesmaid, no. The statues will be covered. And he went, and you can't get married inside the communion rail, on and on and on. And I hung up the phone. I was so angry. And then I went to St. Rachel's in Marin. Spoke to the priest, whatever you want. And so I got to see that depending on where you went to church, it wasn't a rule. It was the liberalness, etc. And it went, you know, helped unfold all of that.
Thank you. You've really opened up a whole topic here, I think. Our own, our personal journey of claiming seeing true, right? Other, how about other journeys or other ways in which people have claimed for themselves what's true? Yeah.
Well, I was raised in a household essentially kind of without rules. But it wasn't one of moral relativism because my parents led by example, I think. But I was largely left to figure things out myself, which I just so cherish.
Yeah.
And to this day, I'm really loath to give advice to anybody.
Yeah.
And I just led, I've led a blessed life, I really have. And I think by, at least by my mid-20s or late-20s, I was able to figure this stuff out.
Yeah.
I think because I didn't have that parental dogma, you know, that, and I didn't have any religious push at me. And I just am so thankful for that, because it's allowed me to, now, some people in the same situation without rules end up in juvenile hall. You know? I don't know why I went right and somebody else went left. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I just credit my parents. They weren't perfect, and they got divorced and had ramifications
for
me and things like that. You know? But being free to find that myself was a gift that has led me, led a blessed life.
That's great. Thank you. So valuing that gift and also recognizing that we can support others in that. How about, Rob, I asked the question of what's your own, maybe your own journey of claiming for yourself what's true or feeling more trust of yourself. Yeah, and then we'll probably wrap it up here.
I'll give you that real quick because this isn't what I wanted to say.
Okay.
It was right after I got my driver's license.
Yeah.
And I went to church. It was in Palos Verdes. And I confessed. And the priest said, never have sex again. But you have to say 10 Hail Marys. So I was walking up towards the altar, thinking, what the hell? And before I got to the altar, right at the altar, I turned around and I ran, literally, not figuratively, ran down the hall, down the nave, I guess it was, down the stairs and into my car and drove away. Yeah. So there was a specific moment where it ain't gonna work anymore. Yeah. But what I was thinking about while you were talking, especially while you were talking, because I don't remember if it was Mark Twain who said, if common sense is so common, why is it uncommon?
Excellent.
And it led me to think all of the things that we've been talking about, the five moral guidelines, having alcohol, whatever, the sixth, let's say, the invitation to think for yourself, to not follow the gurus, to not follow, you know, one of Buddha's main things is don't just have things for the sake of artifice. Why are all those things the most popular things on the planet?
What things?
The opposite of all those things. The negation of all those things seem to be the most popular activities on the planet.
I'm still trying to track which is which.
All of the moralistic guidelines you've been talking about,
yeah,
the opposite of those are very popular.
Okay.
Thinking for yourself, the opposite of that is extremely popular.
Uh-huh.
Don't follow a guru, listen to yourself. That is even more powerful than that.
Yeah.
All of them combine to strangle. It seems to be very popular to go through life strangled.
Hmm. Thank you.
Why?
I guess, yes, maybe just leaving it with the question, and also this question of what's your own journey of claiming your own authority, in a sense? What you know to be true, like how have you done that? What's been important for you along the way? And then related to that, what's striking to me, kind of back to this point, I think, to emphasize this, the Kalamas were illiterate villagers. They were dirt poor farmers, ordinary people, through whose village these ascetics and Brahmins, very elite, would come in and tell them how to think. And what's so poignant, if you really feel that, the Buddha is saying to these completely ordinary people, low status in the culture of the time, you can trust yourself. You can trust yourself. See what you see, know what the fruits are, for better or worse, and act accordingly. You can trust yourself. And then he leaves. He doesn't leave behind some kind of special book for them to read every day or some. He doesn't leave a priest behind to impose some kind of structure upon them. He says, you can trust yourself. I trust you to see for yourself and act accordingly. Look how powerful, isn't that?
I would suggest, though, that people are innately good, wouldn't they?
They have to do the work, but yeah, innately good, as long as to do the work. See for yourself. Okay, how about we sit for a minute and wrap it up? Well, take care. See you next week. We will be meeting the Wednesday's the evening before Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
yeah, we'll still, I'll be here. You're welcome to come. What a sweet occasion to give thanks before the madness begins the next day. See you then.
Is there a website where we can see the schedule?
Yeah.
Yeah? What is it called?